The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Aloha, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his science officer, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 70 of The Big Picture for the week beginning July 31. And coming up on today's show, live long and prosper. We've got all the best Star Trek Beyond to chat about.
And once you're finished being thrilled about the future, we're going to chill you with horror flick Lights Out.
But don't worry, Jason Bourne is on the way to save the day in Jason Bourne.
Jason, g'day, Mark. Good to be with you on episode 70. We're 70. Mate, you don't look a day over 69.
It's all that clean living.
We are going to be talking about Jason Bourne. They couldn't come up with a better title than Jason Bourne for the fifth Bourne movie.
Don't you feel like that is just a marketer's decision? How will they identify with themselves? Just call it what it is.
Just call it what it is. Jason Bourne. We'll be talking about that later in the show. Before we get there, some other things that are around this week, Mark. Jason Bourne's dominating cinemas, but on the small screen, you can relive, if you've seen it, and if you haven't seen it, go and check it out, Eddie the Eagle, which was released on Blu-ray and DVD, which I dared to call earlier this year, Mark, the feel-good hit of 2016, and I stand by my convictions. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com, check out my review of it there. The film with Taron Egerton, Hugh Jackman, based on the true life story of Eddie the Eagle, that British underdog who was one of the most famous losers of all time at the Winter Olympics. Good little movie.
Yeah, I think you called it Billy Elliot with skis.
I did. Yes, Mark. Thank you for remembering. Thank you for remembering.
That's
you listened.
Right. Stuck in my mind. Okay, well, if you're looking for another repeat performance, have a look at The Bachelor. Bachelor Australia started season 4, episode 1 went to air this week with 22 hopefuls vying for the hand of 31-year-old Richie Strahan. He's used to hard and greasy work in the mines of Western Australia where he works as a rope technician. So in theory, he should cope well with the highs and lows of reality television. Strangely so, a little sad insight here. Apparently had a great deal of problems associated with filming this series.
Oh.
Because none of the bachelorettes wanted to actually stand next to him, apparently.
What?
I know.
Does that defeat the concept of the whole thing?
Google that and you'll understand, because I don't want to insult the guy on here. There we go.
Okay. Also on the small screens at the moment, a movie that you highly recommended this year, Mark, Sherpa. Excellent documentary.
Oh, wow. This is very good.
Again, go to bigpicturewebsite.com. Check out Mark's review of Sherpa. One of the only movies that my wife Amy and I have seen together at the cinema this year, Mark, was Sherpa. And
did you go on my recommendation?
We went on your recommendation, and now take Amy's recommendation and mine. We loved it. Excellent movie that captures what happened on Everest in 2014 when 16 Sherpas died in an avalanche and kind of the fallout from that event. Incredible documentary about whether people should or should not be on Everest and the way Sherpas are treated. Sherpa is out now, DVD, Blu-ray.
And speaking of high up in the air, Forces of Nature with Brian Cox begins on the ABC this Tuesday.
I really like the actor Brian Cox.
Yeah, there you go. And episode 1, this is actually Professor Brian Cox, so it must be his brother.
Not the actor Brian Cox. I've heard of that guy.
Unless, of course, he actually got a degree at some point.
No, I think there is an actual scientist called Brian Cox.
Well, Professor Brian Cox combines some of the most spectacular sights on Earth with our deepest understanding of the universe to reveal how our planet's beauty is created just by a handful of forces. Just the balancing of just a few forces that, you know, the way God's put things together, I guess.
Mate, some entertainment news. This lady's name you may not know, Marnie Nixon. She died on Sunday in New York. She was 86. You might not know her name, but you recognize her voice. She's a classically trained singer, and she sang in some of the most famous parts on screen in musicals in kind of Hollywood's golden days. So she dubbed the voice of Deborah Carr in The King and I. She was Natalie Wood's voice in West Side Story. I always thought that West Side Story performance by Natalie Wood, I didn't think she'd be able to sing like that. And she also, Marnie Nixon, was the voice of Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady.
I knew that. Yeah.
Marnie Nixon died 86 in New York, will be best remembered for her voice that she really didn't get as much credit for as she probably deserved.
I was really depressed when I found out that Audrey Hepburn didn't actually sing in My Fair Lady.
It was Marnie Nixon.
There you go. She was wonderful. And now she's gone. She'll be sadly missed. Well, it seems that Hollywood has now added its voice to the presidential campaign against the force of nature that is Donald Trump. More than 100 actors, producers, and others from the entertainment industry are banding together in an effort to keep reality TV star turned GOP nominee Donald Trump out of the White House. What catchy name have they taken for themselves? Artists United Against Hate.
Which sounds kind of hateful.
How do they feel about him? I do not know. But anyway, you've got the likes of Samuel L. Jackson, Kerry Washington, Julianne Moore, Mark Ruffalo, Michael Moore. No surprise there, really. Okay. Neil Patrick Harris, bunch of others. The group's mission statement reads, "We believe it is our responsibility to use our platforms to bring together attention to the dangers of Trump's presidency."
There wow, you go. Which they file under one word, hate.
Hate.
Wow.
Let me just summarize everything you stand for.
Wow, I'm sure they'll be open-minded in their response. Mark, before we get to our first review this week in the What Your Kids Are Watching section, Star Trek Beyond, I'm going to deliver you a true or false fact that relates to Absolutely Fabulous. The new Absolutely Fabulous movie is opening at cinemas this coming Thursday. You're going to be talking about it on next week's show.
Indeed I am.
To get us in the Absolutely Fabulous frame of mind, writer and star of the show, Jennifer Saunders, is a self-confessed procrastinator. And so she thought she probably would never get around to writing an Absolutely Fabulous movie. She even did hypnotherapy, apparently, to get this project going. The co-creator...
It has stretched on for ages, hasn't it?
It has.
I'm quite surprised it's taken
bazillions
so long.
Of years. Yeah. And the co-creator of the show, Dawn French, bet Jennifer Saunders £10,000 that she could not write the film script. Is that true or false that she bet her to motivate her to write the film script?
£10,000.
Yeah, $80,000.
Wow. I can't believe the rate of the dollar.
Find out the answer to that after we go to What Your Kids Are Watching. Now, I've been asked to read this out word for word.
Word for word.
By my co-host Mark without changing a single word of it. So here goes. It's a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife or a Star Trek sequel. Oh, I see where you're going here. And lo and behold, better than a sequel to Pride and Prejudice comes just such a gift from heaven, really?
It's a stellar thing.
Yep. Star Trek Beyond, the third film in the rebooted sci-fi series, or the ninth film in the Enterprise series, or the 13th film in the Star Trek filmography.
It's important to be accurate.
Do I really have to
read it? Yes, keep going.
Right. It's like the third one's finally landed in Australian cinemas, like the long-heralded arrival of the Borg in the Alpha Quadrant in whatever season 3 of episode 74. Jeepers, Mark.
Please, people want to know this stuff.
Star Trek Beyond is angling for a family audience with its clean-cut characters, superpowered spaceships, and snazzy leisure suits. Director J.J. Abrams lit the flame of the reimagining of this sci-fi classic, but has his successor, director Justin Lin, been able to carry the torch? Well, we've asked Mark to find out.
You spent all this time trying to be your father. Now you're wondering just what it means to be you.
It isn't uncommon, you know. It's easy to get lost. In the vastness of space, there's only yourself, your ship, your crew.
You really want to head back out there, huh?
Mate, is the J.J. Abrams magic still there in this third in the reboot franchise of Star Trek?
Justin Lin from the Fast and Furious franchise has basically picked up the story. You wouldn't let it go, would you? We couldn't get through it without you rubbing my face in.
The fact that you love Star Trek so much and the new director of the new Star Trek movie is the guy from the Fast and Furious franchise and you cannot stand the Fast and Furious franchise.
Everybody,
I find that funny.
Everybody is allowed a moment of redemption, okay? It's my Christian duty to let this guy rise above Fast and Furious.
And it's mine to stop sniggering at you. Please continue.
Please. Well, Justin Lin picked up basically where the story left off. If you remember, they got given an Enterprise and a 5-year mission. And so we get a sort of
sense. Was that in Star Trek Into Darkness, the last film?
Yeah, right at the end of it. So basically, they set off to discover the universe. And then we find out, you know, quite quickly that Kirk gets a bit bored of it after about 3 years.
Yeah, he's having a bit of an existential crisis.
Yeah,
what's my purpose? Where am I going? Isn't it all meaningless? Am I ever going to find the ends of the universe? No, I'm not. What am I doing here? What?
Yeah, and then eventually they crash the place. But look, it's fast-paced. It's thrilling. There is a few things in it. An unbelievable motorbike scene, which I think was lifted from some unused section of Fast and the Furious. Honestly.
You would have loved that bit.
I looked at it and I just went, really? Okay. Why not just bring Vin Diesel in now? Anyway, and there's lots of spacecraft, alien threats, and dastardly plots.
Mate, so back to my original question then. Is the J.J. Abrams magic still in Star Trek Beyond?
You know, I don't think so. No? And it takes me a lot to say this, but I guess when you say, like, take this from a Star Trek fan, there are great Star Trek films, and this will be a good 7. You know, it'll, you know, it's
maybe 7 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. It won't be one of those ones. I think it is everything you want it to be. And because of that, there's no surprise.
Right. Like,
every expectation you expect. There's a great space battle. There is the crew struggling against odds. There's a villain. There's, you know, and everybody's pretty much playing their roles. There's crisis in relationship. There's Spock being inhuman and finding a human side to himself.
But it's basically, you know, like one long episode of the TV show.
Yeah,
would you say?
I would say that it's probably 3 long episodes of the TV show. Look, it's not bad. I want to be really clear about this for the rest of the Trekkies out there. You're going to have fun. You're going to enjoy it. And if your kids are into science fiction, this is a safe movie. They're going to have great fun. It's probably safer than many. But at the same time, you know, there are a few things you've got to be aware of.
Now, we've picked this week for what your kids are watching because we think it's the movie at the moment at cinemas that's really pitching for, particularly the teen dollar. But do you reckon the kids are going to get into it? You just mentioned there that if your kids are into science fiction, they'll probably like it. But really, are they going to dive in?
There's a few things in it that are really a bit complex. Like, I feel like there's a lot of complex motivations. And so, look, most kids, I hope, will just look straight over it and watch the spacecraft. But, like, you've got Kirk, as you said, with his existential crisis. You've got Spock breaking up with his girlfriend because he can't understand whether or not he has a greater duty to his race or to himself.
Even every Vulcan's problem, Mark.
Yeah, every Vulcan's problem. Even Krow, the villain played by Idris Elba, has abandonment issues. You know, it's weird. It's just a little bit too complex. And I guess, if anything, one of the issues I think I should raise here for the parents is that there is some sexual content in it, but not the sort that you think. If you're concerned about your kids and the homosexual marriage debate, one of the key characters is kind of outed as a homosexual in a long-term committed relationship with a daughter. Okay, and so they show
as in he has a relationship and they have a daughter, the pairing.
When
does.
I say outed, it's not even it's the wrong choice of words, weirdly, because it's like, here's the future, and in the future no one will have a problem with this, which is a none too subtle way of saying, you know, everybody should in society should get behind this. And I'm a little worried sometimes when they put those images in front of kids as if this was just an assumed thing.
So quickly then, it sounds to me like there could be moral lessons to be drawn from this future that we're invited into in Star Trek Beyond, because Star Trek's always been known on TV and in movies for having some deep things to say to us about the world in which we live. So when we think about the future that's presented in Star Trek Beyond, anything that much to take away, you found?
Yeah, first it's post-God. Okay, so there's no real mention of God. Occasionally, Star Trek's actually been quite aware of the fact that there's more than we know out there. But God doesn't even rate a mention in the sense of a certain degree of mysticism or anything in this film. But I think probably the most important thing is the film just hits you over the head again and again and again that the most important thing about humanity is unity. That, you know, we're able to accept each other. We're able to have compassion for each other. And even though the alien bad guys say, that's your weakness, we find out in the end, into again, some very unsubtle scripting, that that's what it is. Unity is the most important thing. But the weird thing is that Jesus went one step further. And what he did was he said, look, neither do I condemn you, when he's talking to the lady who's caught in adultery. But he adds on, so there's no condemnation in Star Trek. There's more support and everything. But he adds on one more step. Actually, we're reaching for something. Go now and sin no more. You know, it's
important. Go and change your ways.
Yeah, it's not important just to accept everyone, to have compassion and realize we're all struggle, sure. But we're still aiming for something. God still wants us to be his children. So go now and sin no more.
Star Trek Beyond has warped into cinemas across Australia with Simon Pegg, Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, Zoe Saldana, Carl Urban, Idris Elba all aboard. If you'd like to take your little Klingons where no Trekkie family's gone before, bear in mind it's rated M for violence and science fiction themes. Who would have thought that, really? Star Trek Beyond. Mark, before we talked about Star Trek Beyond, I posed a true or false statement. The co-creator of Absolutely Fabulous, Jennifer Saunders, she is a self-professed procrastinator. The co-creator with her, Dawn French, of Absolutely Fabulous, bet her £10,000 that she could not write a script for the movie. True or false?
Now, I'm going to go with true, because Dawn French must have known her better than anybody else, and she would have thought that's a safe bet.
Mate, you're exactly right. And as it turns out, no, it wasn't.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't. Well, she's lost. She's written the movie. We're going to be talking about it on the show next week.
I really should have known that she actually wrote the script.
Yes, you should have.
Okay, well, still coming up on the show, we've got heaps of stuff. We've got a thriller mashup, actually. If you're actually into thrilling films, we're going to give you a chance to guess your favourite soundtrack. Not to mention the fact we've got one of the scariest films out there coming up too. Welcome back to the show. Look, long-term listeners of our show and podcast will realise that occasionally I just like to torture Ben. And that's
occasionally?
Occasionally. Every now and again I like to sort of like take my vast knowledge of soundtracks and things like that and throw them at Ben and see whether or not a couple of them knock him off his seat.
I think the expression is rub it in my face.
Well, you know, I'm actually set up a thriller mashup this
Ooh.
Time. So I'm going to play some thriller songs for you from great thrilling, scary films, right?
Okay.
So we're going to be talking about Lights Out. Hang around for that. That's coming up. It's going to be a great film to talk about. But first, we're just going to test your general knowledge. How many of these themes can you identify? Ben, I'm going to give you a chance to get 5 out of 5 this week.
Whew. Really?
We will run around the room
cheering.
Are you
saying that they're this easy? Well, even I will be able to guess them.
I was quite surprised at how identifiable they are. So why don't you roll the first one?
Okay.
You've got it already, haven't you?
Mate, if I didn't, you should fire me from this seat. Jaws.
Of course, 1975,
surely.
Steven Spielberg's take on Peter Benchley's novel. Yeah.
Mate, all right.
Well, there you go, 1 for 1.
1 for 1.
I hope the audience is playing along. I hope you guys are all feeling good about yourselves. Okay.
I am.
Now,
okay, number 2.
Number 2.
I believe I've got this one already as well, but we should let it go on just for a little bit longer.
Now, be careful.
That's how much longer? I really want to say The Twilight Zone.
You really want to say that?
I would like to.
Because it is. It's The Twilight Zone. 2 for 2. I don't think you've ever actually scored 2.
I don't think I have either. What a great day.
Yeah, well, I mean, for a series that ran from 1959 to 1964, clearly it carved its way into the social strata. Look, the TV series is bizarre, unbelievable, probably only available on DVD now. So
all right.
It's amazing people still know it.
Let's go for number three. The X-Files?
Yes!
Mark!
Well done. You've actually achieved a goal which I'm sure your parents were hoping and praying for long ago. You've got over 50%.
It's obviously taken from that very famous science fiction TV show that also sparked some movies, and it had a reboot recently.
That's right. Fox Mulder and Dana Scully were back recently for the 10th season. 2016 marked the 10th season. So
wow.
There you go.
All right. Number 4.
Okay. It's going to get hard. This is the one you have to think about. The Tubular Bells. And let me give you a clue if you're struggling. Max von Sydow.
Yeah, I didn't think I was. And I was going to get it before you even said
that.
Because you are talking about The Exorcist.
I am. I'm talking about The Exorcist.
Wow, what a good creepy piece of music that
is.
Yeah,
absolutely the creepiest one
I think
there.
People do forget Tubular Bells is actually from The Exorcist, which we may have now ruined the memory of Tubular Bells for a lot of people. All right, that was number 4. So I'm doing 4 for 4, right?
Are you ready?
My goodness
We'll be high-fiving, I'm
okay.
sure.
Okay. Oh, mate. Oh, you served this up on a platter. Oh, I really want to say Psycho because I'm, correct, am I not?
You are. 1960, Alfred Hitchcock, the infamous shower scene in which he kills off his star, Janet Leigh, in the first 20 minutes. High five!
Mate, I can't believe you actually did what you said you were going to do. You served that up to me so I could get all 5. I appreciate that very much.
That's because it's our 70th birthday. Well, despite all that fussing around on thrilling soundtracks, Ben and I aren't huge fans of scary movies. I can speak for Ben when I say that he's a bit of a squealy baby, actually.
A little bit, yeah.
Don't sit next to him. It's kind of like sitting next to a jumping jack, you know, if something like that's going on. When it comes to those sort of movies, he tends to freak out a little bit. So who better than Ben, then, to see Lights Out?
Of course.
A new dose of screen spooking about 2 kids haunted by their mother's past. Is this just another horror slash fest to avoid, or a chilly reminder of mental health and strength in solidarity?
Well, let's talk about, I mean, you tackle some serious issues here. This could have been easily been a just fluffy horror film, but there's serious mental issues. There's a lot more depth in this than your average. How did that come about?
That was very early on. I felt that I wanted to do something with sort of mental illness and depression or something, because in a way, you know, that's a sort of darkness as well, like within people.
Yeah.
So it felt like a sort of a natural link. And I think Originally, it was even more overt, almost that this was an allegory for sort of depression and mental illness.
Mark, that was director David Sandberg being interviewed by a movie website, Joe Blow, about Lights Out. David Sandberg's a Swedish guy, which you might not have been able to tell from his accent.
Fairly solid American accent.
Great accent, those Swedes. This is his directorial debut. Lights Out is based on a short film that he made. And as he was explaining there, it started out life more as he described, an allegory for mental illness and the darkness of depression that can come. And when what it's changed into, by his own admission, is it became a little bit more of a fun movie in the telling of it as a big screen event, which is a little bit of a shame, because I really liked Lights Out. I enjoyed it way more than I expected to. And I thought, when hearing more about what he was saying, that it was based on the idea of being kind of trapped in the darkness of mental illness, would have been even better if he dived into that darkness a little bit more. It is definitely there, and you can think about Lights Out from that front, but it is also a chilling, creepy piece of work that's really just designed to freak you out.
Yeah, and I'm kind of surprised, because I know, like I said in the intro, that that's not a big thing for you. Were you surprised by what you saw?
I was, mate, very, very much so. I should say very quickly, it's about a woman called Rebecca, played by Australian actress Teresa Palmer. She's estranged from her mother, Sophie, who's played by Maria Bello. And Rebecca's got a younger brother, Martin. Gabriel Bateman plays him. And Rebecca comes back into the life of Martin and Sophie because Martin is all kinds of scared because his mum has an imaginary friend. And one of the great ideas in Lights Out is David Sandberg realized when he's putting this together that one of the most frightening things you can think of is if your parents aren't looking after children like they should. And it's not just kids being like scared or haunted or, you know, ghosts that like kind of creeping around them like in Poltergeist or something. But when the parents are and the kids are in that situation, what on earth are they going to do?
So when kids see that parents are afraid,
yeah,
that is one of the scariest things.
Yeah,
out there.
Yeah. And so what I was most surprised about with Lights Out is that from that idea, and if anyone who's seen the trailer would know that the basic premise of this is when you turn the lights out, there's like spooky, shadowy creature lurking in hallways and houses that these characters are in. And then when you turn the lights back on, they're gone. And it works very well.
Well, that's simple enough. Just don't turn the lights off.
That's right. And people really definitely attempt not to. But where that could have gone and where you might expect it to go,
it doesn't. Did anyone have a flashlight?
Their flashlights do turn up. Even one guy is actually saved by the light on his phone at one point, which is really quite funny. Like it's handled very well. So there were so many things I was surprised in about this, but most particularly that I enjoyed it so much, and I wasn't as appalled, offended, shocked by it. It was just genuinely creepy.
Well, how about we just delve into that for a second? Because many Christians hear horror film and then say, okay, I'm not going anywhere near that period. Is there an argument for this? I guess we're not talking about Saw or Insidious or these sort of gore films.
Which is surprising, because this is from Australian filmmaker James Wan, who is effectively a one-man horror chiller franchise machine. He created Saw, he created Insidious, he created The Conjuring, which a sequel to that was out recently, like a couple of months ago, and now he's behind this. So he either created them or produced these massive films now on the kind of horror landscape, and he does seem to bat at both ends of the spectrum. I think Saw is at one end, or at least the Saw sequels were.
Which is more like, yeah,
gore fest.
Torture porn.
Torture porn was the expression that was kind of coined around the time Saw came out. There were other films like Hostel, which were basically, they seemed to be just exercises in people trying to find different ways of carving people up and for the apparent exhilaration of viewers, which I found really quite repulsive. Whereas Lights Out, I think, is close to the other end of the spectrum. Very little blood and guts, much more about what can scare us, what can terrify us most about life. And even if whether you take ghosts seriously or not, whether you take being haunted seriously or not, in contrast to, say, Ghostbusters, that's up on screens at the moment. We reviewed it on the show the other week. Check it out, thebigpicturewebsite.com, for what we said about Ghostbusters. But in contrast to that, this film, like The Exorcist that we just mentioned a little bit earlier, treats very seriously the supernatural realm. It's still a popcorn movie, Lights Out, and it does get a little bit silly towards the end as it, you know, tries to wrap itself up, and some of the things Teresa Palmer has to do, like credibility starts to wane, which is a real shame because it upholds it most of the way through. And one of the impressive things about this, apart from the fact that it doesn't really have much blood and guts, is that it's trying to shock us with what could be going on in the supernatural realm.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, look, most horror films have moral drivers. Okay. There's someone did something bad and that's why this has happened, and there's a sort of revenge plot or something like that. Is there a moral driver in Lights Out? Do you get any moral lesson out of it?
Well, it's not like the usual one that you're sort of referring to, that where it's like a retribution punishment. Someone's done a crime and they're going to be punished for it. And
not
so
like a Nightmare on Elm Street.
And so that's why, why Nightmare on Elm Street's happening, or why you're being chased down by a particular force. I found the moral force of this movie kind of coming from a different direction, and it's not so apparent until you get right to the end, and it gets a little bit heavy-handed in its delivery, this moral lesson that's being taught. But very interestingly, Lights Out kind of boils down to this leave no one behind, band together, we're a family, don't ditch us in our hour of need movie. From the kids kind of realizing that they shouldn't ditch their parents if their parents are struggling, which is quite an amazing concept, really, to try to get your head around. So
it's usually the other way around.
That's
parents
right.
Rescuing the
and
kids.
That's fair enough, and that should be expected. That's the position parents are in. And I think David Sandberg has really tapped into something here along the lines of how terrifying it is when your parents aren't protecting you the way you should be. But then in the flip side, and particularly Teresa Palmer's character, Rebecca, as an adult, drawn back into her family life and recognizing and having to admit that as much as it was, as much as she was a young girl and she was terrified herself, she did cut out on her mum when her mum was in desperate need. So
there's a strange, like, honour your parents theme running.
There is honour your parents. And there's also, there's plenty of Christian teaching that I think that upholds this kind of idea of if someone is struggling, and particularly if it's in a family member, let alone anybody else, not just to cut and run on them, not to just, like, don't abandon them in the hour of need, look after the sick and the vulnerable and all those sorts of things. That, I think, emerges from Lights Out more than just being freaked out by it, which I did find is a very chilly film. I was super impressed with it.
No worries. Well, Lights Out stars Australian actress Teresa Palmer, Gabriel Bateman and Maria Bello. It's showing at cinemas all over the place. It's rated M for supernatural themes. Again, a big surprise. Violence and sustained threat. Is the idea that you're going to be scared a lot and for a fair while.
Yeah, you're getting a rating now for what the film actually is, like for the content. Weird.
Well, it seems the movies now get rated on how well they hold tension.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not bad. Mm. Well, actually, speaking of things that hold tension, we have been fairly tense for a fair while now waiting for Ben-Hur. The remake of Ben-Hur is coming out in August. We're thrilled. In the next edition of, actually, the August edition of Eternity, Ben's actually got his article on Ben-Hur. So I encourage you to check out the website or go have a look at the paper for that. But we're also going to be doing a little bit of a giveaway. Yes, we actually have 10 double passes.
Free stuff.
Come here and get the merch. Actually, there's no merch, but we do have the tickets.
Yeah.
Okay. 10 double passes, and this is all you have to do. You know, we have a Facebook page. If you haven't found it by now, honestly, what are you doing on Facebook?
At the Big Picture Show. Come and find us.
Go to the Big Picture Show's Facebook page, and all you have to do is write, "I love togas, and I'm not afraid to say it." Okay, so write, "I love togas, and I'm not afraid to say it" on our Facebook page. We'll send you a double pass. How easy is that?
Man, that is super easy. And also super easy is sticking around with us, because should your kids watch the news, we're going to have the answer to that really soon. And also Jason Bourne, Jason Bourne is coming.
Welcome back to the show. Here's a question that's basically perplexed me for years as a television news journalist. Should your kids watch the news? If you're a parent or caregiver, that's a question you want to answer too. On last week's show, Ben interviewed Lynn Worsley, a prominent Sydney psychologist and director of the Resilience Centre. Listen to the podcast to hear Lynn's professional advice about how to help our kids dealing with disturbing stuff that they see in movies or on TV shows. This week, a slightly different topic. It's part two of Lynn's interview, and she tackles whether the news is helpful or not in helping kids to thrive.
I would never be recommending a child sit in front of the 6 o'clock news.
Really?
And watching that day in, day out, or the 24-hour news, because essentially what the child's hearing is continual bad news for that time.
What you're meaning there is, what, that's too negative, too constantly
it's
negative?
It's too negative, and it's reporting on real life experiences, and it's just reporting on the negative, and it's very pessimistic. So, I mean, I'd be saying, you know, we can watch the news for a little while, let's listen to the headlines, or let's listen to some of the news, but let's turn it off and talk about it, and let's see if we can see that it's actually not everything is bad news. Isn't it a shame they're not talking about some good things that happened today? So to always keep a child in perspective, that they need to know that what they hear on the news is not reality, in that, you know, 24/7 there's bad news happening and the only protective bubble is at home, but rather that, you know, there is a perspective to be given and that there's some really good things going on out there, and just sometimes the news tells us just the bad things. It's that sense of using the situation to prepare the child for life rather than protecting them. So I'm a great advocate for preparing and not protecting. If you protect a child, you stop them having the experiences that they may need to build on for their life experiences. So if you prepare them, you see that everything that happens is an opportunity to build some skills for life for later on. Even if it's upset, even if it's sadness, even if it's fear, even if it's something that's happened that's really, really tragic and they've had to experience it. And even if that's the case in the real, if they've lost somebody, to use it as an experience that's going to be building their skills for future. That's a little bit of a mantra that I keep coming back to. And I think too, we're very cautious about trying to upset children. I'm not telling you to go and upset them. But, you know, if it's watching a movie that is designed to be a G-rated movie and then it's got surprising things coming up in it, rather than getting upset and anxious about it when your child's going to pick up that, use it as a way of talking them through and giving them an experience that would be helpful.
Well, we've reached that highlight of the show. Actually, no, I shouldn't call it the highlight because you might turn off at this point. This semi-highlight, there's better stuff coming of the show when we talk
They're
about...
They're all highlights, Mark. They're all highlights.
The spy thriller franchise that has wowed fans over the last 14 years, returning a cool $1.5 billion at the box office, is back for a fifth try at your cinema dollar. The Bourne Identity films did for Hollywood espionage films what Ferrari did for four-wheeled vehicles.
Injecting. What?
Yeah, that's what I feel.
And explain that for me.
Oh, well, you know, basically, before then, we had sort of spy films that were kind of just all in one direction, nothing
yes.
terribly special, and then a whole new life got injected into
oh,
them
I
thanks
see what
to the
Bourne
franchise.
Yes.
Hence the Ferrari four-wheel analogy.
Gotcha.
Now I'll move on.
Please.
That's okay. Well, they basically injected a racy, brutal realism that thrilled audiences far more than
True.
The CGI effects that had come to dominate the previous films like Bonds and stuff like that. Well, Matt Damon's back as the amnesiac assassin in the self-titled Jason Bourne, and Ben headed off to the cinema to see if he was still capable of knocking out the competition.
He's seen things. He knows things. What if he's not coming for us? What if it's something else?
I volunteered because of a lie. This is Jason Bourne.
I need to talk.
32 kills. People are safer because of what you did.
Mate, let's just ask the question right out there. Is Matt Damon looking old?
Yeah,
I mean, it's
is.
Been 14 yep. years.
Since he started out as
Bourne? 17 years if you count the production time, since he stood on camera as Jason Bourne.
Wow. That's entirely true. And what's he now, about 46 years old, I think, Matt Damon?
He is 45.
He's 45.
I know this because he and I share a lot in common.
like being international men of mystery.
Well, certainly yes, mysterious.
Look, I think he is looking old, but he's meant to be. He remains as the title would suggest, Jason Bourne. He's still on the run, still living in this hidden life off the grid, and still plagued, haunted, tormented by his assassin past. When we first meet up with him, he's on the Greek-Albanian border in some sort of underground fight clubs. They're not actually, they're overground because they're in the back of with the wilderness in Greek-Albanian border. And then from there, what comes out in the rest of Jason Bourne is basically an older version of Jason Bourne, because Matt Damon is actually older, as we pointed out, going about the same stuff that he always goes about in these movies. I'm a huge fan of the first three Bourne films particularly. I understand they're a repeat every single time of basically the same premise of this assassin who lost his mind, lost his memory, and then as he recounts it, he tries to work out his past and he gets kind of angry and not, and then goes and kills people and doesn't. I get that they're the same movie over and over. I really enjoy them. This one, though, Mark, I struggled with the fact that it felt like a rehash too late.
Like you're going through the numbers.
Yeah, it's not terrible, but it's not, it didn't, like we were talking about with Ghostbusters the other week, even what you were saying about Star Trek Beyond earlier in the show, does it justify its reason for being there? I don't think it does. Like, there's not, what the why doesn't come through strongly about why did you go back. And the director, Paul Greengrass, who made the second and third Bourne films and kind of really, really revolutionized the look and feel of the Jason Bourne films and spy films, as you said, he's back with Matt Damon. Why did he show up for this one? Why did they both go back to that? Well, it's a little bit dry, so I'm not really sure why they were trying to drink out of it.
Yeah, it's not like they needed the money.
I wouldn't have thought so.
No. Okay, well, look, the Bourne films have always been about Jason's identity, okay? Mm-hmm. So finding out, like you said, finding out who he was and often not being happy with the result. Does this film just basically trace that trajectory?
Yeah, is it exactly the same? Pretty much. You were saying to me off air, and I think you're right, it does feel like, was it the Bourne Supremacy? The Bourne Ultimatum, the third
Ultimatum,
one.
The Bourne Ultimatum, yeah.
It felt like the same plot of that. And this one is a kind of delving further into Jason Bourne's past. It's almost like the script writers, Paul Greengrass being one of them, thought, oh, what elements of his past haven't we tapped into? Oh, what about his parents? What about his dad? Maybe his dad could have some sort of involvement with why he became what he became. Let's have his dad be the sort of catalyst for the story in Jason Bourne.
Do you think they're setting us up for the Bourne pedigree? What happened to his parents?
Like, so next it'll be what his cousin, like how his cousin impacted his life.
Oh, the Bourne family.
And how that may or may not have influenced his decisions. Interestingly, this, I thought Jason Bourne had Bourne set in the real world a little bit more than some of the other Bourne efforts.
Well, yeah, you're mentioning tensions on the Greek-Albanian border.
Yeah, and you also get this really long sequence to kind of kick the movie off proper in Athens when there's a lot of riots going on that are some sort of pointer to recent events that were going on in Greece around political instability. And then you also get a lot of talk about social media and privacy and surveillance and freedom online. All these issues that are kind of raging and rumbling.
And dot coms.
All this stuff that's kind of raging and rumbling around the world. And yet nothing's really made of it, I didn't find, in Jason Bourne. So it's all there as a backdrop. It's very interesting, but it doesn't dive into it much further than using it as a backdrop for Jason Bourne to again come at the CIA for what they've done to him and find out the truth about his past, if he will ever find out the truth, because everyone's always lying to him anyway.
Well, if there's a moral center to the Jason Bourne franchise, it has to be responsibility.
Jason,
he's always asking himself, is he responsible for his actions? Is he? Have we found out? Is he finally responsible or is he not? Did he get let off the hook?
I feel like we keep going back to the yes or no answer on that. Yeah, I think there is a bit of letting off the hook. This one may be stronger than some others. So the more you find out about his past, and a lot of that's done through a new character, Tommy Lee Jones. There's always this like craggy old sea dog guy or woman at the CIA who's been there since forever. Some reason we've never heard of this guy really, but Tommy Lee Jones shows up and he's sort of a deep distant past of Jason Bourne and is like intimately involved with why he got involved with all of this assassin stuff. He shows up, Alicia Vikander, who won, I should know her name. She won an Oscar recently. She's in this as a woman in the CIA kind of helping Bourne out. You get all of that. And in amongst all of their plot threads and what they've got to do with his past, I did feel like they're often getting to this point of suggesting one side will suggest Bourne's responsible for his actions. The other side doesn't. And Jason Bourne himself really struggles to come down on a conclusion about whether he is or he isn't. Fascinatingly, though, I wish they'd follow up a little bit more on choice. The fact that he has a choice, and that does show up a lot in all the other Bourne films, this one included, talks about choice but doesn't really lean on it heavily. As a Christian, I really like the idea that in life we have choices. A lot of people will go on about the almost a right to have choices. I think God's injected into the world, into humans, the ability, we've got free will and we've got responsibility that comes from choices. A lot of us don't like the fact that we're held to consequence for that, but I love it. I love the fact that we have the ability to make choices. We are responsible people. So the two things can go together. Jason Bourne attempts to bring those together, but usually retreats from that point and then just sets up for another sequel, which you know may or may not show up in the future.
Tell me, did he wander off into the background?
And maybe Moby was playing at the time, that Moby theme song that always plays. So choice and responsibility, they always get to the threshold, but it doesn't quite go over the line. And that was just one of the disappointments among quite a few in Jason Bourne, this return to this franchise that I think really might want to just drift off into the sunset.
Oh, well, Jason Bourne rated Okay. It rated M for mature themes and violence. It opened at cinemas across Australia this Thursday, where you'll find Matt Damon, Julia Stiles, Tommy Lee Jones, and Alicia could be Vikander, we don't know, chambered and ready to fire.
Insights Magazine is a website, great supporter of us. Go to insights.uca.org.au. Check out Russ Matthews' take on Jason Bourne, because here's the short story. He was a much bigger fan of this than I was. So get along and see what Russ had to make of Jason Bourne and why he's more thumbs up than thumbs down. And Russ is also going to be showing up on the show next week, Mark, because he is going to try to convince me in 3 minutes or less why I should watch Jerry Maguire, which I've never done. That's coming up on next week's show. But still to come on this show, what the Bible has to tell us about Ghost, and then a top five list that I can barely put into words, but you need to stick around and find out what it is. Welcome back to The Big Picture. Now, we've had Hollywood's opinion on things that go bump in the night in the shape of Lights Out that we talked about earlier in the show. But let's turn to a more credible source. Are there spooks, ghosts, and ghouls for real? For real, as in the real world. What does the Bible have to say about that? Well, cue Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark for another dose of insight.
He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. That's from the Bible book called Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 11. Have a look at it. Well, human beings have always been fascinated with the afterlife. You can see it in all of our storytelling and our songwriting. We write and sing about heaven and hell, about seeing our lost loved ones again, or about the horror of death. And because we long for the afterlife, because we have this sense of eternity in our hearts, as our Bible verse says, we're also intrigued with what happens between the time we die and the time we arrive there. It's not an easy area to talk about. There's a lot of garbage out there, speculation about what happens when we die, and that makes people fearful and confused. But the Bible can really help us to see through the fog. Let me give you just a few pointers on the afterlife that Scripture has to offer. Firstly, it tells us that death is not the end. The Bible teaches that human persons survive death to face God in judgment for their lives. Well, that's quite daunting, but it's better than the alternative, which is ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Secondly, death is actually a state of being. That may sound weird, but it means that when you're dead, you're not really dead. You've entered a different state of being. When you are dead, your body may decay, but your being does not. You survive. And the Bible uses several images for this. For example, it talks about being safe in the shadow of the Lord, or by God's side, or fallen asleep. Well, the fact that in a few places in the Bible, there is mention of spirits or ghosts appearing to people, tells us that our being does survive the grave. However, what is also clear in the Bible is that it is not our place to go searching for such spirits, like some kind of holy Ghostbusters, or indeed like the psychic medium John Edwards, who tries to connect people with their lost relatives. In the one place in the Bible where a ghost is summoned, in the book of 1 Samuel, it's condemned as a disobedient act. Once people have died, they are God's to deal with, not ours. But my final point is to emphasise something very, very beautiful, that God remembers us. Whatever life throws at us, whatever tragedy strikes us or our family, whoever we lose on the way through, God remembers them. Death may cause people to fade from view for us humans, but not for God. He has an everlasting capacity to remember us all and for none of us to be forgotten. It's mysterious to us, but it's also very comforting.
Mark, almost end of the show. And how do we end off every show? With a top five list. So it is pretty much one of the best parts of the show. But
yeah,
the reason I'm sounding a little bit vague or confused is because our top five list this week, I can't even put into words because I have no idea what it is. You tried explaining this
idea to me.
And I don't know how you're actually going to do it. So please, fire away.
I pitched this idea in a meeting and somehow I think we were running out of time. So we managed to just go with it. But follow me on this one. Okay, it's been a mixed week, right? Okay.
Yes.
For the big picture, we've had a sci-fi extravaganza in Star Trek Beyond.
Yes.
A spine tingler in Lights Out.
Yes.
And a spy thriller and Jason Bourne,
all those things are true.
Okay. None of which are terribly linked.
No.
No, okay. So for this week in our top five, I thought I'd do my level-headed best to honour all three genres in the one top five list.
What do you mean?
By finding films that offer everything they have to offer.
This... Five.
That's very good. You preempted me already. This is my top five spy thriller sci-fi classics. Yep. Every one of them is a bona fide spy thriller sci-fi classic.
Wow. So starting at number five, what is it?
Number five, Total Recall.
Oh.
1990.
That's okay. A reasonable choice for your sci-fi.
The sci-fi setting. Here's the sci-fi. Planet Mars, 2084. Here we are. We've sort of got a mining venture going on. The spy, okay, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger's Douglas Quaid, the lowly factory worker. Turns out to be a spy who's had his memory erased, right?
Sounds familiar.
And the thrill and the chill part, okay, the mutants on Mars. I mean, honestly, do you remember those scenes? Yeah.
I do, yes.
Okay, and the mystery machine at the heart of the planet. It's going to turn on and no one knows what. And a lot of gore by director Paul Verhoeven. So there you go. Sci-fi, spy, thriller. Let me do it again. Four.
I'm a little bit more convinced than I was a minute ago.
Do you think I can get five?
No.
Blade Runner, 1982.
Mm.
The sci-fi setting, a dystopian Los Angeles, 2019. It's based on a Philip K. Dick novel. Interestingly, so was Total Recall. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was the Blade Runner one. Who's the spy? Well, he's kind of more of a detective. Okay, I'm stretching
but I'll give
bit.
You the spy thing. Yes, yes. He Rick does sleuth and snoop.
Yeah. Rick Deckard, Harrison Ford's character, is a true cross between sci-fi and detective noir. Okay, he's trying to find all these creepy androids. There's the thrill chill, okay? Especially that Roy Batty character played by Rutger Hauer.
Oh, great character. Yeah.
I know, a horrifying android who just wants to live and basically experiences that by going around and killing people. Huh.
Three.
You don't think we can go all the way to five,
no, I'm still quietly stunned, but I think you're actually somewhat convincing me of
sci-fi,
this.
Sci-fi, spy, and thriller in every film. Right. Oblivion, 2013.
A film that few people saw that Tom Cruise and Morgan Freeman was in?
And most people missed out on an extreme pleasure. I thought it was a great film.
Really?
Okay. Don't you roll your eyes at me, producer. Sorry. The sci-fi setting, Earth in 2077, after the planet's been devastated by an extraterrestrial invader.
Yeah, of course.
Invader, and humanity's going to head off to a moon on Saturn. Well, you know, that's what you do. Who's the spy? Well, it's a kind of unknown operative like Jason Bourne. Tech 49 Jack Harper, played by Tom Cruise, doesn't actually know that he is, in fact, a plant. Okay, I don't want to give too much away from that.
What?
And the thrill and the chill.
You're not just thinking about Tom Cruise in like Mission Impossible and just inserting it in this movie,
I'm not,
are you?
I'm not. He literally is an amnesiac in this situation. It's quite interesting. And then the thrill chill factor. Well, there's this disturbing, really watchful wasteland that Earth has become. Sort of one of the best bits of cinematography in the entire film is just the idea of feeling intimidated by the landscape itself and the creepy alien creatures that live beneath the surface. Or do they?
Oh.
Two.
Thus far, Mark, you have been doing all right at this ridiculous idea of a top five. One of the most tenuous top fives I think we've ever done. And we've had some tenuous ones that link to stuff in the show.
I'm going
to
write a book on sci-fi spy thrillers.
You're the one guy who's been waiting his whole life to write that book.
Okay, well, at number two, Pitch Black. Okay, came out
starring your favourite actor, Vin Diesel, from the Fast and Furious franchise, which you love.
Don't rub it in. The sci-fi setting, a wrecked mining station on an unnamed planet somewhere in deep space, somewhere in the distant future.
Sure.
The spy, Richard B. Riddick. Okay, Vin Diesel. Now,
is he a spy?
No, he's more of an assassin.
Okay, which I guess in our week of Jason Bourne, he's more of an assassin than a spy.
Yeah, he's the conscienceless killer type. Okay.
Consciousless killer. He has no conscience.
If I could say it. That's right. This man has no conscience. Again, like Bourne, who's on his way to a maximum security prison for murder until the spaceship crashes.
Whoa.
Okay. And now the thrill chill. Well, they've landed on a planet where night is going to go for weeks. Okay.
A little bit like Lights Out, as in there's a lot of darkness.
Yeah, there's a lot of darkness. That is a bit of a...
I'm helping you out here.
I don't need any help. I'm doing well, damn it. Anyway, and these light-sensitive monsters are finally being released from the from the underside of the planet. You know, it's great fun. It's an incredibly low-budget film.
Mm, it was.
That is really well done.
And I'm not a Vin Diesel fan whatsoever, but that is the one... I think it's the one Vin Diesel film, apart from maybe Saving Private Ryan, that I would go back and watch. Pitch Black is a really good piece of work.
Saving Private Ryan?
Yeah, he's in that. Yeah.
Yeah,
yes, true
right.
story.
Yeah, yeah,
yes,
yeah.
he
I'm
is.
Not, I'm not kidding at all.
But let's not talk more about your favorite actor in mine, Vin Diesel. Number one?
One.
Yeah, here is my number one sci-fi spy thrill.
Okay, and we've already had Total Recall, Blade Runner, Oblivion, Pitch Black, which I'm still quite impressed that you've been able to manage four.
Let me give you five.
Okay.
Solaris from 2002. Okay. Now, I don't know if you've seen this film. If you haven't, if you're a sci-fi fan and you haven't seen this, honestly, you really should. It's a great thrilling film. It's a great sci-fi setting. A space station orbiting the planet Solaris that's been discovered by the human race, okay? The spy is actually Dr. Chris Kelvin, played by George Clooney. George Clooney in a sci-fi. It's really good. He's been sent out to find out what's going on, even though apparently he's just a technician, another sort of worker, yet he's arriving on the station to really work out what's happening, because the thrill chill, well, they lost contact with the crew. Why? Because most of them are dead. And weirdly, that wouldn't be such a strange thing, except for the fact that those that are wandering around don't want to talk about it.
Wow.
Okay.
That is kind of weird. And are you suggesting that George Clooney's character here is spying?
Well, he's trying to uncover the mystery of it. Okay.
Yes.
I really wanted to say Solaris is a film people should see. Okay.
Yes.
But actually, interestingly, his wife. The whole thing just seems like a straightforward sort of something bad must have happened on the station until his dead wife turns up, the one who committed suicide many years earlier and sitting on the end of his bed.
Weird and chilly.
Yeah, and now we suddenly realise that it seems the planet itself has plans for the people on board. Well worth it.
How did you get here?
I love you so much. What's wrong?
That's not your wife. You're dreaming her. She's alive.
You found me.
I came for you. This is my chance.
You don't know what you're in for.
Go back. Go back to Earth. You'll die here.
You're being manipulated.
We are not taking her with us.
Are you going to stop me from taking her back?
Mark, I'm really quite amazed that you managed to pull off the top five sci-fi spy thriller list. I don't think that's ever in the history of ever happened.
I'm now going to prance around the room in triumph.
And we were here to witness it. And that's been the show. That's a really good way to finish. What's coming up on next week's show?
Well, old school for the new school. What TV shows of yesteryear should our kids really be watching?
And we're going to dare to discuss the provocative new Australian comedy about the Cronulla riots, no less.
And darling, it'll be absolutely fabulous if you join us for the glitz and glam of the Ab Fab movie.
And I promise I still will remain Ben McKechnie.
And I will be Mark Adley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.